Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I am Bobby Jean Schweitzer, an associate editor for Anesthesiology, and you are listening to an Anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with two authors of two publications in the April 2023 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Aman Mahajan. Dr. Mahajan is the senior author of an article titled GABAergic Signaling During Spinal Cord Stimulation Reduces Cardiac Arrhythmias in a Porcine Model. Dr. Aman Mahajan is professor and chair of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Dr. Mahajan.
Thank you, Dr. Schweitzer. Thanks for inviting us to share our work.
And joining Dr. Mahajan is Dr. Karsten Bartels. Dr. Bartels wrote an accompanying editorial, Modulating the Cardiac Autonomic Nervous System, Stay Close to My Heart or Keep Your Distance. Dr. Karsten Bartels is professor of anesthesiology at the University of Nebraska in Omaha, Nebraska, and a member of the Outcomes Research Consortium in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome, Dr. Bartels.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Mahajan, let's start with you first. Can you just briefly tell us, or maybe not so briefly, what were you trying to determine with this particular study?
Indeed, Dr. Schweitzer. The overarching goal of my lab is really to understand how autonomic neural networks in the spinal cord control cardiac arrhythmias and cardiac function. And in this particular study, we wanted to study the role of GABAergic signaling in the spinal cord modulation of cardiac sympathoexcitation during myocardial ischemia, and also specifically determine how GABA pathways are involved in the therapeutic benefits of spinal cord stimulation.
So, Dr. Mahajan, let's start with maybe helping us understand more the role of the autonomic nervous system, specifically in pathologic cardiac conditions, maybe not just in sort of our normal hearts.
You know, autonomic nervous system is frequently involved in either the genesis or worsening or maintenance of cardiovascular disease. And this includes both acute conditions that we see in an operating room or an ICU setting, as well as in chronic conditions such as chronic hypertension, heart failure, cardiac arrhythmia, sudden cardiac death. In fact, sudden cardiac death due to ventricular fibrillations is actually the single largest cause of death, and autonomic dysfunction is a major reason, etiology for sudden cardiac death.
So, Dr. Bartels, for those of us who may have forgotten, and even though we, you know, interact with the heart and the autonomic system every day during anesthesia, can you maybe review more specifically the autonomic innervation of the heart?
The autonomic innervation of the heart is basically a balance of sympathetic and parasympathetic tone. Sympathetic stimulation increases heart rate, contractility, and conduction velocity versus opposite effects from parasympathetic stimulation. Now, diving a bit deeper, there are cardiac preganglionic sympathetic neurons that originate mainly in the cervical and upper thoracic spinal cord. And note, this is where Dr. Mahajan's group placed their stimulator in this study. And these preganglionic sympathetic neurons then synapse with sympathetic nerves that actually innervate the heart, for example, in the stellate ganglion. Now, parasympathetic stimulation of the heart is mainly conducted from the 10th cranial nerve or the vagus nerve, and that's mostly direct.
So, Dr. Mahajan, what do we already know about neuroaxial modulation in cardiac care?
So there's a fair bit of information that's available and knowledge that's been developed in the preclinical and the animal models, and more recently also in humans. What we do know is work done by our group as well as others subsequently, what we've shown is that spinal cord stimulation reduces the sympathetic excitation that we see in conjunction with myocardial ischemia or with other heart conditions where there's an increase in cardiac afferent activity from cardiac dysfunction. And spinal cord stimulation will actually reduce the sympathetic output directly to the heart. And it also actually reduces the baseline sympathetic activity that's seen in stellate ganglion. It reduces the sympathetic activity that's controlled by the intracardiac neural network. And these are neurons and a neural network that's on the surface of the heart. So the spinal cord actually controls all of these, and spinal cord stimulation can actually stabilize these networks without actually reducing cardiac function at baseline. More recently, there are other types of spinal cord stimulation or neuroaxial modulation through dorsal root ganglion stimulation, which we and others are now showing that can also reduce cardiac arrhythmias and cardiac excitability.
So I think your title says that, and this was done in a porcine model, which are pigs. But first off, was any component of it done in humans? And why did you choose the pig model that you did?
Yes, I mean, the entire study was actually done in a pig model. We've developed this pig model over the past several years. And we've chosen this model because it's a large animal model, very translatable to humans. And the pig anatomy and cardiac electrophysiology is very similar to humans. Using an animal model such as the model that we use does allow us to study the mechanisms in greater detail, which we may not be able to study in a human model. It does allow us to do molecular analysis in the spinal cord, which again, will not be able to do in humans, and get the insights about neural networks in the spinal cord and the GABAergic pathways that we were interested in looking at. But certainly, you know, it is important to understand that not every finding that we have in an animal model can be translated into humans. So certain aspects of human studies would need to be repeated after this.
And when you mentioned about molecular information, that means you actually sacrifice these animals, right? And this is not something you could have done through PET scanning or other kind of methods of evaluation, correct?
That's correct, yes. And in our study, we actually, once we were able to record our physiological data, we did sacrifice the animals and remove the spinal cords for doing further molecular assays.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Bartels, can you help us compare spinal cord stimulation to, I guess, other cardioprotective mechanisms, for example, to beta blockers?
Yes. Beta blockers exert their cardioprotective effects directly on the target organ, the heart. While individual beta blockers may vary in what kind of sort of ancillary properties they have, all beta blockers antagonize the beta 1 adrenergic receptor. And that is thought to be the mechanism that is most responsible for the therapeutic benefits in cardiovascular disease. Now, spinal cord stimulation, on the other hand, occurs much more upstream centrally. And as we now know from Dr. Mahajan's work, leverages GABAergic mechanisms to decrease sympathoexcitation and ventricular arrhythmias, in this case, after myocardial ischemia reperfusion, from a much more upstream location.
Dr. Mahajan, in the manuscript, you stated that all of the experiments were performed during daylight hours, 6:30 and 1900. What was the significance of this? I don't think I've ever seen that stated in a study before.
That's an important aspect of our study. As we all know, that changes in autonomic function occur during the day, and these diurnal changes are there in humans, they're there in animals as well. So it was important for us to make sure that all these subjects and the pig model pigs that we employed in our studies were experiencing this similar environment during the experimental phase. So all the groups could be compared, and the results could be extrapolated in a more exact manner.
So I find that really fascinating, and I assume that must have been the case, but I didn't know whether it was maybe because, you know, the investigators had to have a good night's sleep or something. But I'm particularly interested in personally because I grew up on a pig farm, and I remember the animals kind of sleeping intermittently through the day. I didn't think of them as sleeping sort of 8 hours a night or 12 hours a night and then being up during the daytime. So it's really true that the autonomic system is sort of correlates very similar to humans in daylight hours?
Well, it may not be exactly the same as humans, but there's certainly in every species, the autonomic changes are quite similar. And even though there might be variances between the same subject from day to day, but overall patterns are very similar. From our experimental standpoint, because we chose a randomized approach for all our animals and we wanted to make sure that each of our subgroups, and there were several of them, the animals were actually experiencing similar environment. So the autonomics, which is a key aspect of our investigation to study, would remain similar and comparable.
Sure, it makes a lot of sense. That was very interesting information for me to learn about. So you had a very extensive experimental protocol for this study. I kind of was almost exhausted just reading about what you guys had to do to prepare these animals and line them up and whatever. As I recall, you had sort of phase one and phase two. So can you tell us a little bit about phase one of the study?
So in the phase one of the study, we wanted to just compare the effects on cardiac electrophysiology and cardiac arrhythmias secondary to acute myocardial ischemia and reperfusion, and then how spinal cord stimulation, the neuromodulation, would actually change the parameters that we were recording for cardiac electrophysiology. It allowed us to make sure we have a good model and we were able to see the results we were expecting from spinal cord stimulation. So in the first phase, we actually were able to demonstrate that spinal cord stimulation did indeed reduce the ventricular arrhythmia score, which again shows the burden of arrhythmia secondary to acute myocardial ischemia and reperfusion injury, and also the sympathetic excitation that occurs secondary to ischemia reperfusion injury, which we measured from the reduction in ARIs, which is activated recovery interval, and that's a surrogate marker for action potential duration. So in other words, as the sympathoexcitation occurs, and sympathoexcitation occurs following myocardial ischemia, cardiac afferent fibers carry the signals to the spinal cord, and spinal cord releases catecholamines secondary to the stimulation of preganglionic sympathetic neurons. As a consequence of that, the action potential duration, or the ARIs, would shorten. So we were able to demonstrate in phase one that spinal cord stimulation or neuromodulation was able to mitigate the reduction in ARIs, as well as to reduce the incidence and burden of cardiac arrhythmias.
So Dr. Bartels, in your editorial, you discussed the rationale and use of vagal nerve stimulators to treat heart failure. I know that heart failure wasn't really the focus of Dr. Mahajan's study, but I thought there was some interesting information that you discussed there. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. When one reads the title of the manuscript, one might wonder, you know, will this ever be translated? And so we thought we wanted to look at other more remote upstream mechanisms that can be exploited to reduce sympathoexcitation. And vagus nerve stimulation is such an option. So the procedure includes placement of a transvenous lead into the right ventricle for sensing, and then the actual nerve stimulation on the vagus nerve, usually on the right, to increase parasympathetic tone. And that intervention has actually been tested in humans in heart failure in a large trial of over 700 patients. While the primary outcome of that study was not different, it does show that these types of upstream or remote interventions that one wouldn't typically think about maybe when treating a heart disease have actually already progressed quite far down the translational spectrum.
Interesting. So, Dr. Mahajan, maybe you can tell us now a bit about phase two of your protocol.
So phase two really had us understanding the mechanisms that are involved in how neuromodulation works. What we wanted to test is if one, GABAergic pathways are involved, and there are different GABA receptors in the spinal cord, GABA A, GABA B, And we use the antagonist of GABA-A, that's bicuclin, and antagonist of GABA-B receptors, that's CGP55845. It's a compound which is a specific blocker. And then we also use a GABA transaminase blocker called gabaculin, which has an effect of increasing the concentration. It prevents breakdown of GABA, so it increases the concentration of GABA. So our goal was to understand if GABAergic pathways were involved in neuromodulation.
I don't think we have time for you to probably tell us all of the details about the physical preparation of these animals. However, my first question is, how long did it take you to do the experiments and the preparation on just one of these piglets? And did you have to anesthetize them first?
Indeed, yeah, these are long experiments, very complicated, require a large team. The typical experiment will last anywhere from 6 to 7 hours. And the preparation itself, which is performing the surgeries, instrumenting the animals, making sure we have the right measurements recorded, that in itself takes up to about 2 to 3 hours itself. And we did anesthetize these animals first, because as you can imagine, to do open chest surgery or spinal cord instrumentation would require an animal to be anesthetized. So we did anesthetize them first.
So can you tell us about some of the procedures you actually performed on these animals to allow determination of your endpoints?
So, you know, our goal was to study the effects of autonomic stimulation modulation on cardiac excitability, which meant that we needed to record cardiac electrophysiology directly from these, in our case, from the surface of the heart. So we had to do a sternotomy and put in a custom-designed electrode array all around the heart so we could record at high-resolution electrophysiological signals. We also performed a laminectomy to be able to place intrathecal catheters for delivery of the pharmacological drugs. And then, of course, that also allowed us to extract the spinal cord after all the experiment was done in order to study the molecular pathways. Besides this, these animals were fairly well instrumented to understand the effect on the cardiac function. So we had placed in intracardiac pressure monitors, monitors for recording left ventricular function. And then, of course, once the spinal cord was extracted, we had a detailed protocol for doing molecular analysis that included immunohistochemistry as well as Western blots.
Wow. You know, it sounds like you did a combination of open heart surgery, electrophysiologic procedure, and neurosurgery, which all of us as anesthesiologists know that even one of those tend to be one of the lengthier kind of cases we do, yeah. And combining all of them together.
Indeed. And I must say that, you know, we did do the typical procedures, intervention that anesthesiologists do in their clinical practice, which is injecting drugs in the intrathecal space. So we actually did that as well. And we did spinal cord stimulation at traditional frequencies of 50 hertz.
So throwing in the pain physicians into that whole mix as well, it sounds like.
That's correct.
Amazing. So Dr. Bartels, you know, you talked a bit about these vagal nerve stimulators that we've already had some information about their use in heart failure patients. And you mentioned about, you know, sort of just looking at the title is like, how would this possibly translate into humans and clinical practice? So do you think it's realistic to think about using spinal cord stimulation or even intrathecally administered medications in the setting of acute coronary syndromes? These are often things, you know, we don't plan to have, right? Or is this something that, you know, in anticipation of, I guess, higher risk surgeries, or how would you see this translating perhaps?
Well, you point to an important limitation of spinal cord stimulators given the current technology. These patients would often require heparin, dual antiplatelet therapy to have their coronary thrombosis treated, or if they undergo cardiovascular surgery, they might have to be heparinized for cardiopulmonary bypass. However, I would say that despite these current limitations, that shouldn't preclude our enthusiasm for the research in the field. Now, to use an analogy, think of how large a conventional transvenous permanent pacemaker is versus one of the novel leadless implanted pacemakers. Those new devices are about 90% the size of a traditional transvenous pacemaker, yet for a lot of the properties, they're just as good. So I think, yes, there are limitations right now, but we should continue to do the research that'll be required to take the next step.
A very important point, I think. You know, sometimes it's hard to sort of see directly the benefits of a very basic science or, you know, even translational research projects, but it's the future that these help inform us of, you know, things to be able to develop the clinically, you know, useful processes and treatments.
Yeah, and I would agree with Dr. Bartels that unlike the research and clinical applications for vagal nerve stimulation, modulating the sympathetics is still an evolving field. And although there have been a couple of human trials done with spinal cord stimulation already, as technology develops and as we discover more non-invasive approaches for modulating spinal cord or spinal cord neural circuits, then we will certainly benefit from the insights gained from the mechanisms that we're elucidating.
Sajid Mahajan, I think you ligated the left anterior descending coronary artery in these pigs with the intention of inducing arrhythmias, right? But did they all get arrhythmias? And if not, what were other endpoints that you were seeking?
So this is a fairly reliable model for inducing arrhythmias. And, you know, nearly all animals actually developed some form of arrhythmias. And these arrhythmias were characterized as either premature ventricular contractions, sustained or non-sustained ventricular tachycardias, or ventricular fibrillation. And our endpoints were the burden of arrhythmias, the severity of arrhythmias in these animals, as well as the activated recovery intervals, which, as I alluded to earlier, are a surrogate for action potential duration, which shortens during sympathoexcitation. So it was a measure of increased sympathetic discharge at the level of the heart.
Dr. Bartels, is there a role for regional techniques or interventions in the treatment of ischemia or arrhythmias?
As Dr. Mahajan pointed out, myocardial ischemia frequently leads to potentially fatal ventricular arrhythmias. And if ventricular fibrillation recurs, it's referred to as electrical storm. And in this more acute setting, sympathetic blockade via stellate ganglion blockade has been shown to be effective, at least in small clinical trials. I would say at this time, this is usually a last-ditch effort that should be considered somewhat experimental. But we have performed that here in our ICU, actually. And when I reviewed some of Dr. Mahajan's earlier work in the context of this paper, I saw he had a paper on showing feasibility of that approach using a stimulator in the stellate ganglion. Dr. Mahajan, can you just comment on that?
So yeah, we've our group over the past couple of decades have been working in this field, and to your point, we've employed multiple different approaches for neuromodulation, both at the level very centrally in the spinal cord, dorsal root ganglion, like you just mentioned, stellate ganglion, and we've used approaches that are commonly used by anesthesiologists, such as doing a thoracic epidural to block sympathetics in someone, in a patient that would have a ventricular storm that you pointed out to, or doing even a surgical excision of the stellate ganglion, a stellectomy, for patients who otherwise would have died, but subsequent to the procedures have lived for several years. So clearly modulating the sympathetics, stabilizing them, reducing them through many of these approaches, and we can use different approaches because patients might have some underlying limitations on one approach versus the other.
Maybe we can get to some of the results of this study. I know you discussed a bit of it when you were telling us about the two different phases, but can you recap and tell us again, how did the spinal cord stimulation alone affect the outcome of the ischemia or the arrhythmias?
So with ischemia, you see an increase in neural trafficking signals that go to the spinal cord. And there's a cardiospinal neural network that we are characterizing now which influences the preganglionic sympathetic neurons. And these are from the T1 to T, thoracic 1 to thoracic 4 segments of the spinal cord. They control the sympathetic output of the spinal cord to the heart. And with ischemia, the sympathetic output increases. And what we showed in this study is that with neuromodulation using spinal cord stimulation, one, that sympathetic output was reduced, and the incidence and burden of the arrhythmias, the ventricular arrhythmias, was also reduced in the cohort of subjects that had neuromodulation.
You then subsequently gave this intrathecal compound, which would block the intrathecal GABA receptors and stimulated. What happened there?
We wanted to study what would be the role of GABAergic pathway. And in order to test that, we gave GABA-A and GABA-B antagonist. Now, if spinal cord stimulation was working through an increase in GABAergic signaling, then we would mitigate the therapeutic effects of spinal cord stimulation. That's exactly what we saw. When we gave both GABA-A blockers or GABA-B blockers, we actually saw the benefits, the therapeutic benefits, the antiarrhythmic effects that we were seeing with spinal cord stimulation were actually reduced.
And then I think you administered GABA transaminase inhibitors, which would increase GABA concentrations, right?
That's correct. So we actually, when we did give GABAQLN, which is a, as you pointed out, is a GABA transaminase inhibitor, so it increases GABA concentration, we actually saw an effect that is that was similar to the effect with spinal cord stimulation, suggesting and affirming that neuromodulation in a big part works through GABAergic pathways.
Very sophisticated and, you know, checking up on your results, right? Not only identifying, but then doing the opposite to see whether you saw what you expected to see. So Dr. Bartels, in your editorial, you write about how, you know, dangerous having surgery can be. You know, I think you share some numbers that some people probably won't be surprised at, but I think that many people are surprised at. Can you put in perspective, I guess, having surgery compared to other causes of mortality?
Yeah. 10 years ago, when I was a fellow, we looked at the magnitude of perioperative mortality, 30-day deaths, relative to the most common causes of death using basic epidemiologic data analysis. And we found that in magnitude, deaths within 30 days after surgery were similar to what would be the number three cause of death. Now, of course, one cannot infer causality from this statement because post-operative is not per se a reason or a cause of death, but such comparisons still hold true. And there was a recent Lancet piece, relatively recent 2019, that looked at global burden of post-operative death. And they showed that of the deaths that occur worldwide, 8% occur within 30 days after surgery. Whereas, for example, the top one and two causes of death, ischemic heart disease and stroke, occur 10% of the time. So while such sort of illustrations are not causal, I do think, or don't prove causality, I do think they point to where and when our specialty needs to focus its effort to improve outcomes. And that is the entire perioperative period, inside and especially outside the operating room. And that is, I think, why this work is so important.
Mm-hmm. Because I think usually the number one or number two cause of mortality in the perioperative period is from cardiovascular events. So Dr. Mahajan, can you summarize the clinical implications or the future, either your need for future research, or where do you think the next steps are to help us understand more how to clinically use this information with what you found in this animal study of ischemia?
The data from this study provides important new mechanistic insights into how spinal cord stimulation is reducing the cardiac ischemia reperfusion-induced sympathetic excitation and ventricular arrhythmias. The majority of work investigating mechanisms underlying spinal cord stimulation to this date has largely been focused on nociceptive pathways. And we've and others have established that autonomic modulation at multiple levels of the cardioneural axis can be beneficial. And if you understand the mechanisms better, we can actually make these therapies much more effective. For instance, recognizing now that spinal cord stimulation is working through GABAergic pathways, perhaps we would be able to better design right frequency stimulations or patterns and positioning of spinal cord leads, for instance, to deliver therapy that is able to maximally engage the GABAergic pathways. So that would be one potential example of studies to further engage. And then we are. Would there be a benefit in unilateral versus bilateral stimulation? Is there a benefit in creating perhaps more long-term implantable devices that can provide these therapies on demand by patient? So, studies such as ours lay a foundation for further clinical investigations. And I'm certainly hoping that other groups would take this as an opportunity to expand the understanding of neuromodulation and also perhaps expand the scope of anesthesiology practice and not just providing nociceptive benefits of our approaches, but also through autonomic modulation, both in an acute care setting as well as in a chronic care setting.
Are there any challenges or unique aspects of your study or the findings of your study that you think may limit the applicability of neuromodulation for humans?
There are, certainly are. And, at this current time, neuromodulation through spinal cord stimulation is an invasive approach. We do need to insert or implant catheters in the epidural space. So now, while these procedures are done by most anesthesiologists putting in catheters, but they're usually for pharmacological drug delivery, and insertion of bioelectronic catheters are largely done by a chronic pain physician. So certainly, at the current moment, it's limited to experts in anesthesiology or pain medicine who are familiar with this technique. There are also certain aspects of the invasiveness, as Dr. Bartels alluded to earlier, that an insertion of a catheter in an epidural space might be difficult in a patient that's significantly anticoagulated. So we do need to understand where the limitations might be and perhaps introduce these catheters prior to anticoagulation that needs to occur. So the clinical use of spinal cord stimulation in an acute setting or in a chronic or acute on chronic setting still needs to be determined in the normal clinical workflow.
Really exciting work, though. And again, expanding on the therapeutic implications and, I guess, opportunities for anesthesia and anesthesiologists. I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read these important articles to learn more. Thank you, Drs. Mahajan and Bartels, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.